Hey, this is Chaka Khan, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
This is Guns and Butter.
Now, very important. You might recall this statement by Bush on the, I think it was on the 25th of September 2001, where he said, and this was repeated ad nauseum, you are either with us or with the terrorists. Okay? You are either with us or with the terrorists. Now, the fact of the matter is that the U.S. presidency was already with the terrorists, okay? So that statement is notoriously, that is a contradictory statement, because the Bush family were friends with the Bin Ladens. Shafiq Bin Laden was with the dad. The CIA had been supporting al-Qaeda since 1979, as documented. I mean, we've got tons of documents. So this is a nonsensical statement. You are either with us or with the terrorists. The fact is that the U.S. government is with the terrorists, and that is the stepping stone towards the so-called global war on terrorism.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Michelle Chosadovsky. Today's show, the post-9/11 era. Michelle Chosadovsky is an economist and the founder, director, and editor of the Center for Research on Globalization, based in Montreal, Quebec. He is the author of 11 books, including The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th, America's War on Terrorism, and The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity. Today we discuss the broader geopolitical ramifications of the September 11th terrorist attacks, including the attack on Afghanistan, the global war on terror, and the Western Military Alliance support for the terrorists. Michelle Chosadovsky, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be on the program.
The terror attacks of September 11th, 2001, opened up a new era, as you have pointed out. The very next day, September 12th, a declaration of war on Afghanistan was announced, and the U.S. attacked Afghanistan on October 7th, 26 days later. What transpired between the morning of September 11th and October 7th that produced a U.S. war against Afghanistan? How did this unlikely result come about, and with Afghanistan, of all countries?
Well, that's the crucial question. At 11 o'clock in the morning, CIA Director George Tenet stated unequivocally that al-Qaeda was behind the attacks, and this was before the conduct of any kind of investigation. It was 2 hours later. Subsequently, in the evening of 9/11, at the White House, a war cabinet was created, and late at night, a declaration of war was issued against Afghanistan on the grounds that Afghanistan was a state sponsor of these terrorist attacks. There was absolutely no evidence to support these statements, but nonetheless, they were accepted by the media. And the following day, Central European time in Brussels, the North Atlantic Council, which is the governing body of NATO, issued a statement to the effect that the 9/11 attacks were an act of war from abroad, in other words, implying that America had been attacked by a foreign power, which was totally absurd because there were no jet fighters from a foreign power or Afghanistan in the skies of New York that day. And they invoked the doctrine of collective security under Article 5 of the Washington Treaty, which is the founding document, to the fact that the United States has been attacked by a foreign power, and under the doctrine of collective security, if one member of NATO is attacked by a foreign power, all members of NATO are attacked by a foreign power, and then they invoke self-defense. In other words, we have to defend ourselves, and consequently, we must justify the conduct of a war against Afghanistan. So that is ultimately what happened. That war was, it was not officially declared until later, but the decision was taken invoking Article 5 of the Washington Treaty, collective security, and everybody supported it. All the NGOs, the leftists, and so on, they all supported it. It was an act of retribution to, you know, to Afghanistan having attacked America, but nobody really reflected on the, you know, on the causality, apart from the fact there were no Afghanis in among the alleged hijackers. They were, most of them were from Saudi Arabia, so they got the country screwed up, you might say, in retrospect. But the absurdity of this process was that, as you mentioned, 26 days later, Afghanistan was attacked, invaded, bombed, and nobody within the mainstream media, namely the military specialists and advisors and so on, who understand logistics of war making, would reflect on the fact that you don't prepare a large-scale theater war thousands of miles away in 26 days. It takes months and months and sometimes years to prepare those wars. In fact, you don't prepare anything in 26 days, a conference, a meeting, and so on. So that the whole process was absurd because everything indicated that the war in Afghanistan had been prepared or was in the pipeline prior to 9/11, so that 9/11 was the pretext and the justification for something which was already ongoing. And secondly, nobody begged the question, well, what on earth did Afghanistan have to do with these attacks? And, well, the answer, the official answer was that he was being harbored and protected by Afghanistan. But what the press failed to report is that on two occasions, one in September and one in early October, the Afghan government, which the United States will call the Taliban, they contacted the State Department through official diplomatic relations that they had and said, if you want to negotiate the extradition of Osama bin Laden, we will gladly abide and enter into negotiations with you. And Bush's response was, we don't negotiate with terrorists. And that was the end of the story. The United States had no interest in arresting Osama bin Laden. And I should mention another thing, that when George Tenet made a statement at 11 o'clock in the morning on September 11th, nobody within the media and all the intelligence analysts stated something which is so well documented, is that Al-Qaeda was a creation of the CIA going back to the Soviet-Afghan war. Is it relevant? Of course it's relevant. So that was the onslaught of a new era.
When was the decision to go after Osama bin Laden made?
Well, there was a decision to declare war in Afghanistan I'm not sure whether there was an actual decision to go after Osama bin Laden per se, as an individual. And there's another element which is crucial in the timeline of what happened, and that is that on September the 10th, Osama bin Laden was admitted to a Pakistani military hospital in Rawalpindi, which is a military city. That is one day before 9/11. Now he was given dialysis. Now I mentioned this because it was corroborated by Dan Rather, CBS News, reporting from Rawalpindi. So that there was a CBS report that confirmed that on the day before 9/11, and perhaps most probably even on 9/11 itself, we don't know when he was released from the hospital, Osama bin Laden was in Pakistan and in a military city which is swarming with U.S. military advisors. You don't enter that hospital unnoticed. They knew where he was. Rumsfeld made the statement, I think, the following day, we don't know where he is. It's like looking for a needle in a stack of hay. They knew where he was. Then the question we might ask ourselves, again, all this borders on ridicule. If Osama bin Laden was in a hospital getting dialysis with his kidney problem, how on earth was he coordinating those attacks, those very sophisticated attacks on the buildings in New York City? On, you know, what, from his laptop? Was he in contact with the hijackers and so on and so forth? But it raises an issue. What was the role of bin Laden? And if that report of Dan Rather is correct, bin Laden has had very little to do with actual, conduct of this operation, although he was tagged as the mastermind. Now, there's another element which most people don't recall because it wasn't really reported by the media, is that on the 10th of September, the dad of the sitting president, namely George Bush Sr., was meeting up with the brother of Osama bin Laden. His name is Shafiq bin Laden. No, sorry, Shafiq bin Laden and George Herbert Walker Bush, former president of the United States, meet up at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in New York. It's a business meeting, and they meet on the very same day as these attacks. And then, I mean, anybody who understands police investigations is that if, let's say, the brother of the terror mastermind happens to be there, the first thing you do is you arrest Shafiq, right? I mean, Osama is the alleged suspect. One would assume that the brother of the suspect in an event like that would be at least remanded in custody by NYPD, but it didn't happen. And one would also suspect that the dad of the sitting president at least would be interrogated. We say, what on earth were you doing with the brother of mastermind Osama? Okay. So in other words, double standards with regard to police investigation. You don't look into these things. Was there conflict of interest? Was it an accident? Was it, you know? But again, it looks very fishy that the sitting president's dad was meeting up with the brother of terror mastermind Osama bin Laden.
Right, and those meetings occurred on both the 10th and the 11th, isn't that right, of September?
That's correct.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, The Post-9/11 Era. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Also leading up to 9/11, the days before 9/11, in fact, 2 days before 9/11 on September 9th, Ahmad Shah Massoud, leader of the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan, was assassinated by a couple of guys masquerading as journalists. Now, Massoud, the leader of the Northern Alliance, he was opposed to the Taliban, wasn't he?
Well, you know, I think this event is certainly related. It's related in some way to 9/11, but it raises some very complex relationships, because I think that the Northern Alliance was supported by Iran and Russia and so on. So there was some geopolitics, but I'd have to go into that more carefully. But it was something which was trivialized by the media. There were a whole series of events which were trivialized, and then again, when we got the 9/11 Commission report, which was chaired by the former governor of New Jersey, Thomas Keene, well, there were things in that report. Of course, that's where the debate started on the truth and lies of 9/11. I read through that report when it came out. It was a couple of years later. And what struck me is that the whole narrative of these 9/11 hijackers was based on cell phone conversations emanating from the planes. And they were very spontaneous conversations, but anybody who has travels by plane knows, and that's even true today, that you can't use your phone above 8,000 feet. The technology wasn't available in 2001, and even if it had been available, you would have had to put in your credit card details and everything and so on to get a connection while the terrorists were going back and forth in the aisle. But I checked very carefully, and there have been various studies on that. It just doesn't make sense. They have recordings of conversations taking place at 31,000 feet. Hello, Mom. And yes, something's happening on the plane. But the evidence largely suggests that these conversations could not have taken place given the technology prevailing in 2001. And even the telecom industry has confirmed that. And so the whole official narrative is very tenuous. And the lies can be easily spotted and confronted. And then, of course, this whole debate that came several years later with regard to the buildings and how they collapsed in a few seconds, and then the issue of controlled demolition was raised. And I think that ultimately the whole debate on controlled demolition is unequivocal. It cannot be refuted. But nonetheless, the lies prevail. And of course, one of the big lies was the fact that Building 7, which nobody had heard of until much later, collapsed in the afternoon of 9/11. And the announcement of its collapse was made 23 minutes before it actually happened, so that the media, particularly BBC and CNN, reported that. And they reported something which hadn't happened, which suggests the quote-unquote conspiracy as well as complicity of the media at the highest levels.
As well, with regard to the cell phone calls from the planes that you mentioned, in the subsequent trial of the so-called 20th hijacker, Zacharias Moussaoui, the FBI confirmed at his trial that none of the cell phone calls from Flight 77 that was claimed to have crashed into the Pentagon, that none of those cell phone calls connected. So the FBI itself showed that those claims were simply not true.
Well, absolutely. The FBI did not endorse the official narrative. At least they didn't endorse the 9/11 reports. And some of their headings with regard to Osama bin Laden didn't even mention the September 11 attacks. There was absolutely no evidence that, in fact, bin Laden was behind this. Okay, from the evidence that we've got, the fact that he was in a hospital, the fact that he's a Saudi, he's an intelligence asset of the CIA. Now, very important, you might recall this statement by Bush on the, I think it was on the 25th of September 2001, where he said, and this was repeated ad nauseum, you're either with us or with the terrorists, okay? You are either with us or with the terrorists. Now, the fact of the matter is that the U.S. presidency was already with the terrorists, okay? So that statement is notoriously, that is a contradictory statement, because the Bush family were friends with the bin Ladens. Shafiq bin Laden was with the dad. The CIA had been supporting al-Qaeda since 1979, as documented. I mean, we've got tons of documents. So this is a nonsensical statement. You are either with us or with the terrorists. The fact is that the U.S. government is with the terrorists, and that is the stepping stone towards the so-called global war on terrorism. There was a decision directive which was issued on the 4th of September, to the effect that they would be going after the terrorists, and that was a week before 9/11, and it was then submitted, apparently, it was signed by Bush several weeks after 9/11, but they already had decided that they were going to go after the terrorists and wage a war on terrorism. But in fact, what happened was exactly the opposite. They used the war on terrorism as a pretext to intervene militarily in Afghanistan and in subsequent wars. And at the same time, they supported the recruitment of al-Qaeda mercenaries in different parts of the world, and not only in the Middle East, but also in sub-Saharan Africa and in Southeast Asia. And then these extensive jihadist organizations which were then involved in Libya as well as in Syria and so on, they were supported by Western intelligence. So that on the one hand, you wage a war on terrorism, and then on the other, you covertly support these terror organizations, which become your foot soldiers. And that is amply documented. And that's why, in a sense, the whole geopolitics which started up with 9/11, where it really affects the nature of warfare, particularly after 2003, where the United States will not necessarily intervene in a country in the form of a large-scale theater war like in Iraq or previously, let's say, in Vietnam, but it will recruit through its allies, mercenaries, jihadist mercenaries, which will then go into the country and displace and destroy a secular government which they want to replace and have as a proxy. Now, another thing which is very important to understand, and people, we don't know it because, it goes back in history, but the objective ultimately is to destroy countries. And when they went into Afghanistan, and I mean that going into Afghanistan was not in 2001. It was before that, because the United States supported the jihadists. They supported Al-Qaeda. They supported the Taliban. But Afghanistan was an advanced, modern, secular country, far more advanced than any of the neighboring countries, including Pakistan or India and so on. It had a welfare state. Rights of women were developed in the public sector. If you go back and look at the archives of pictures in the 1970s and even in the 1980s, you'll see a country which is very westernized. The girls are going around in miniskirts, and you see the people in the street, the universities, and so on. So what in essence has happened is that, and this is genocide. It's the destruction of a country. And that has been, I think, the underlying objective, is the destruction of countries. It's not necessarily to win a war, but it's to destroy a country and transform that country into a territory, which then can be, which becomes part of the colonial, it would be a part of the empire. And in Afghanistan in particular, they're very important mineral resources, and they certainly were both strategic interests as well as economic interests pertaining to that invasion, which started on the 7th of October 2001.
You have said that the war in Afghanistan had been a continuous war, that it did not start in 2001. Could we briefly go over some of the earlier modern history of Afghanistan? What about the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan starting in 1979? What led to the Soviet occupation, and what ended it?
Well, actually confirmed by Brzezinski, the insurgency supported by the CIA in Afghanistan commenced prior to the so-called Soviet invasion. In fact, it wasn't an invasion. It was based on an agreement between the Kabul government and the Soviet Union to bring in troops. But that the war had already commenced, and it was the U.S. proxies recruited by the CIA, which eventually was called Al-Qaeda, which were involved in terrorist acts directed against a secular government. And you could say that secular government is rather similar to, let's say, the Syrian government. I mean, the 70s, you see a country which looks like a country, and now that country doesn't look like a country anymore. It's a territory. You see people impoverished, wearing different clothes and so on, it's an Islamic fundamentalist state. At least that's what the media portrays. But that would not have happened if the United States had not supported the jihadists going back to 1979. And we have ample documents to that effect. The madrasas, in other words, the Quranic schools, where the terrorists were, were indoctrinated. Well, the textbooks, where did they come from? They were published by the University of Nebraska, and they were brought to Afghanistan. There was a process of creating these mercenaries and indoctrinating them. It was a very comprehensive project, and that started before the intervention of the Soviet Union. But of course, it's also true that Afghanistan was very much in the orbit of the Soviet Union at that time.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, The Post-9/11 Era. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. What about the cultivation of poppy in Afghanistan for heroin production? How important of a role did the drug trade have in the decision to wage war on Afghanistan?
Well, that's a very important question. First of all, that the opium cultivation goes back, in fact, to the late 70s, and it was a means to finance the insurgency. It was a CIA initiative, and what happened at the time, or at least the situation which prevailed prior to the invasion, is that Afghanistan had become the largest supplier of heroin in the world, producing something of the order of 90% of the global supply of opium, which is transformed into heroin. And what happened is that in 2000, the Taliban government implemented a major drug eradication program, which was based on crop substitution. In other words, the poppy cultivation was replaced, and eventually the production collapsed. And in fact, it collapsed to an exceedingly low level that they had, in a matter of a year and a half, they had brought down opium cultivation to something of the order of 180 tons. It was a 90% collapse in the supply and production of opium. And immediately following the invasion in October, the production of opium from the poppy fields regained its historical levels. And in fact, today, it's something of the order, certainly more than 20 times what it was in 2001. It depends on the base year, but bear in mind that this has economic and geopolitical implications, because heroin is a very valuable commodity in the retail markets across the world, and it's a multi-billion dollar industry. But that money accrues to the drug traders and retail traders internationally. It doesn't necessarily accrue to Afghanistan. But I've looked into it. We're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars of revenue resulting from the opium trade. And certainly what happened is that the invasion supported that trade. Ironically, in 2001, the opium eradication program implemented by the Afghan government and supported by the United Nations was the object of praise and acknowledgement at the United Nations General Assembly, and that was right at the time when the war had started. And I think another important factor is that this increase in opium production in Afghanistan coincides also with the opioid crisis in the United States. In other words, the dramatic increase in the number of heroin users in the United States. And there we have data on that. There were 189,000 heroin users in the U.S. in 2001, and a few years later, in 2012, 2013, that had gone up to 3.8 million, okay? And that would not have been possible without this surge in opium production which occurred in the wake of the invasion.
Do you have any sense of who exactly it is that's making all the money on the drug trade at a higher level?
Well, that's a very difficult question because there are so many, well, there are intermediaries, there are powerful drug cartels, there's money laundering. There's no doubt that this is something which is supported by very powerful financial interests. And we have to note that ultimately this money enters into the Western banking system, into the offshore accounts and so on. It may have been laundered several times before it actually is deposited. Well, no, it's deposited at each stage of the laundering process, but I can't really answer that question, but that's the hidden, that's unspoken truth. It's something which benefits organized crime. It's something which also benefits financial institutions. And we know for a fact that the drug trade is also protected by very powerful politicians. Now, that trade is still there in Afghanistan. I think there are vested interests which are committed to maintaining that trade. It's a very, very important trade. In a sense, it's even more important than the oil. Oil comes first, but after oil, it's weapons, and then it's drugs. And Afghanistan is the largest producer of heroin in the world. In fact, it's almost the only producer of heroin in the world for heroin production. And that yields tremendous amount of money to people around the world who are involved in that trade, drug cartels, financial institutions, and so on.
Is the U.S. today in control of Afghanistan? And as well, what about Pakistan, who, of course, at the time of 9/11, was a big ally of the United States?
No, the U.S. is not in control of Afghanistan. It has a proxy government. But the country, the Taliban, constitute the resistance. Now, I suspect that the Taliban are different to what they were in 2001. There is a resistance movement, and there's also a resistance movement outside of the Taliban that people want the American troops to go out. But there's another dimension to this. If we look at the map, we have a country which is in Central Asia. It has borders. It has borders with several countries. You're right in underscoring Pakistan. Pakistan is no longer within the U.S. sphere of interest. There have been major political changes. Pakistan is no longer a military ally of the United States. It's much more aligned with China now, and it has important trade agreements with China. But then on the other hand, if we look at that region, Afghanistan has a border with China. It's a very small border and a very strategic border. It's called the Wakhan Corridor. Now, what are the Chinese doing? They're building a road which is going to link Afghanistan to Western China, essentially the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region. And the Chinese are already present in the mining industry. So I think what is at stake is that U.S. military presence is there to protect U.S. interests, which are being eroded by other competing powers, including China. But at the same time, they are, in a sense, also protecting, of course, unofficially, the opium trade, which is a multi-billion-dollar operation. There are other aspects to this, is that Afghanistan also has certain strategic raw materials, including lithium. And now lithium, of course, is very important because it is the input into the production of batteries. And the Chinese are involved in that. And so I think that Afghanistan is one of the major suppliers of lithium.
What about Afghanistan's strategic location? Isn't it, and you pointed this out, a major transport corridor for oil and gas and minerals, etc.?
Well, it certainly is, because it has borders with Pakistan, Iran, Turkmenistan. Then it has also a border with China, not a big one. And it was also considered by the oil companies as a major transit route, taking oil from the Caspian Sea basin down to the Arabian Sea. It was called the Trans-Afghan Pipeline Project. So that, I would say, that is important. But historically, Afghanistan has always been strategic. In the 19th century, it was the divide between the Tsarist Russia on the one hand and the British Empire on the other. In fact, they even had a border at one point. And again, if you look at the map, you'll see that it really is at the crossroads of major economic powers. Russia no longer has a border with Afghanistan in the post-Soviet period, but many of Russia's allies, including Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, and Tajikistan, they're very close to, they border onto Afghanistan, and ultimately all these countries now are aligned with the SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Agreement, the SCO, which ultimately is an alliance between China and Russia, but with many of the former Soviet republics, which are members of this alliance. And then Afghanistan, I think, is not observer, it has a partnership agreement with the SCO. In all likelihood, Afghanistan will play a crucial role within this new geopolitical sphere of influence, which is really Eurasia, extending from eastern Russia and China right through to, you know, to the Mediterranean. So I think that is really what is at stake.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosodowski. Today's show, The Post-9/11 Era. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Now, if we go back to 9/11, 9/11 was a pretext and a justification for waging yet another war on Afghanistan. And the objective was ultimately also strategic from the point of view of the U.S. But I think it has been an utter failure from the point of view even of gaining control over strategic raw materials, instating itself economically, and now the military presence there in Afghanistan, the U.S. military presence is not sufficient or insignificant with a view to maintaining a sort of a foothold. And what's happening is that the Chinese ultimately are going to take over. And I think that's ongoing. So this is also, Afghanistan is in a sense also a war. Indirectly, it's the issue of spheres of influence. And the sphere of influence is now being transferred back to China and Russia, to the detriment of the United States. This is particularly true in view of Pakistan's realignment with China.
And What about the extension of Al-Qaeda almost worldwide, which you mentioned a while ago? How did this come about as a result of 9/11? And of course, you've also pointed out at the same time that all of these Al-Qaeda entities are supported by Western intelligence. Does the extension of Al-Qaeda almost worldwide, is that actually what the war on terror is all about, that was created by September 11th?
Well, it certainly is. It's the globalization of these terror organizations. But maybe let me go back to the history. In fact, it even started before the 1979 Soviet-Afghan War, but that was certainly a starting point from the point of view of the creation of Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda in Arabic means the base. And in fact, according to one author, specialist, military analyst, French military analyst, it was the computer database of the CIA. Now, I have no means of verifying this assertion, but it was the base, and it was ultimately the process of recruiting mercenaries. And it was done by the CIA with the support of Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, essentially. Now, and then prior to 9/11, you also had the recruitment of mercenaries which were sent to Bosnia in the 90s. There are the wars in Chechnya, we recall, which was in the Russian Federation, and then in the immediate wake of 9/11, we see the extension of these mercenaries, Al-Qaeda affiliated mercenaries, to a whole series of countries. The wars in Libya, the war in also the war in Syria. Again, it was the influx of Mujahideen, which were recruited. In fact, they were recruited by NATO through various channels, with allies in the Middle East participating in that process or participating in the recruitment. It was Turkey and NATO which were involved in recruiting Al-Qaeda for the war in Syria. Then you had also the Libya Islamic Fighting Group, which is an affiliate of Al-Qaeda, which was it was already there, but it was used by NATO to implement the downfall of the Gaddafi government in 2011. Then you had Boko Haram in Nigeria. You had Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb in North Africa. Then you had Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. There were a whole series of jihadist groups which were spreading and which were supported by Western intelligence. And then if you're looking at Southeast Asia, you'll find jihadist groups in Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, not to a significant extent, and of course also in the Philippines. Now, what this suggests, and I should mention also in China, in the Uyghur Autonomous Region, there have been jihadist groups there going back before 9/11, even before 9/11, and those are supported covertly by Western intelligence, and also at one time it was supported by Pakistani intelligence, the so-called ISI.
Michelle, I just remembered that a long time ago you once mentioned to me that Islamic fundamentalism was a product of Western intelligence. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, it was certainly a strategy of U.S. intelligence to recruit so-called jihadists, and that the process of indoctrination was actually under the auspices of U.S. intelligence. That started in Afghanistan, okay? But it's not it wasn't limited to Afghanistan, but it started in Afghanistan, which was a secular country. And interestingly, in the course of a decade, the whole educational system in Afghanistan was replaced by the madrasas, the Quranic schools. They closed down the public schools, and in other words, the model of what U.S. foreign policy has sought, particularly in the Middle East, is to install Islamic states, okay, and to displace and destroy secular governments and secular movements. And it's not limited, of course, to Afghanistan. You look at the situation in Syria. That was the objective. And actually, we have official documents of the Defense Intelligence Agency of the United States, which actually confirms it. It said, yes, we favor regime change in Syria and its replacement by an Islamic government with which we can transact in a more friendly way. They never denied that. When you destroy a country, you destroy its secular institutions and you replace it by something else. If you look at the Gulf states, well, what are they? They're proxy states, they're allies of the United States. And what kind of government do they have? They're Islamic governments, most of them. Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, to a lesser extent, and so on. The Emirates, these are Islamic governments, and they serve the interests of the United States as opposed to secular governments with some kind of working democracy. That is something you don't want. This also ties into a process of creating divisions within countries which have several ethnic groups or several groups with different religions. Now, the Shia versus the Sunni, and if you take Syria, well, you have Christians, you have Druze, you have Sunni, you have Shia. They all live in harmony with one another until the onset of the U.S. NATO-led war in March 2011.
What about the nuclear posture review of 2001 and the statement that the U.S. was prepared to go after non-state actors who had nuclear weapons?
Well, indeed, the events of 9/11 were conducive, and that's very important, in a shift in military doctrine, but also a shift in nuclear doctrine. They defined the so-called non-state actors. It became a talking point. And those non-state actors are people like bin Laden and so on, and Al-Qaeda threatening America, okay? And it was no longer necessarily Russia who was threatening America, but Al-Qaeda threatening America. And then this nuclear posture review, which was actually brought out in 2001, it was then sent to the Senate, I think, in early 2002. They had defined, first of all, they had defined a new doctrine of nuclear war, which was called preemptive nuclear war. And in fact, this whole notion of preemptive means that you attack an enemy before they attack you. And that's exactly what they did with regard to Afghanistan. They said, well, not quite, but they said, Afghanistan is a threat to our security. Iraq is a a threat to our national security. But there were two elements in this nuclear posture review which are important, is that they identified the non-state actors, i.e. Al-Qaeda, as potential nuclear powers, that they could fabricate a bomb and then they could come and that they could drop that bomb in Washington. These were small-scale bombs. And so that the United States then implemented, actually embodied this notion into the doctrine of going after the terrorists. But then there was another element, is that in that, and that's maybe beyond our discussion today, but they said, we must develop a new generation of nuclear weapons which are harmless to civilians. And that was the U.S. tactical nuclear bombs, which were already there, the mini nukes. And they were planning to use those against terrorists, against Saddam Hussein, against Iran. And because the explosion was, allegedly the explosion was underground, but in fact it wasn't really totally underground, these could be used on a preemptive basis and they were harmless to civilians. So a new era of lies and fabrications was introduced, and it was indirectly linked to the doctrine of going after the terrorists, which was contained in the decision directive of September 4th, signed by the president, I think, in September 25th, 2001.
Michel Chosadovsky, thank you.
Thank you very much.
I've been speaking with Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show has been The Post-9/11 Era. Michel Chosadovsky is the founder, director, and editor of the Center for Research on Globalization, based in Montreal, Quebec. The global research website, globalresearch.ca, publishes news articles, commentary, background research, and analysis. Michel Chosadovsky is the author of 11 books, including The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th, America's War on Terrorism, The Globalization of War, and America's Long War Against Humanity. Visit globalresearch.ca. That's globalresearch.ca. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yarrow Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Rebecca Miles, and I'll be hosting my first solo Midnight Ravers show on Friday, September the 20th, 2019, from 12 midnight to 2 a.m. Join me as I present Tangled Up in Blues, where you'll hear many iconic blues women of yesteryear and today. So mark that date on your calendar, Friday, September 20th, from 12 midnight to 2 a.m., Tangled Up in Blues. Only on WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, you know it'll be raver dynamic.
The Midnight Ravers, where every show is a special.
Hey, this is Chaka Khan, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
Hi, this is Tony Roberts, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth since 1960.
Hi, this is Jerry Stiller. You are listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Where are my keys? Anybody see my keys? Who took my keys?
I was was sitting there listening to him give his State of the State address, and my jaw dropped.
I thought it was wrong for a number of people to blindside me the day of the vote.
We have a schizophrenic healthcare philosophy.
This is Ben Max from Gotham Gazette.
And I'm Jarrett Murphy from City Limits. If you want to understand more about the challenges facing New York City and hear from people running for office or working on solutions, tune in to Max and Murphy. We'll talk to electeds and candidates, experts and advocates, and then open up the phone lines to hear from you. That's Max and Murphy, Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m., right here on WBAI 99.5 FM.